Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Edward J. Gillan, author of Sound Authorities, Scientific and Musical Knowledge in 19th Century Britain. It was published by the University of Chicago Press and released here in the States in February. Edward is the author of several books on a wide variety of topics, from The Palace of Science, which is a treatise on scientific knowledge and the building of the Victorian Houses of Parliament, and Entente Imperiale, a study of British and French power in the Age of Empire. Also of interest is his work on the Cunard Steamship Company, which we are all familiar with, 19th century evangelicalism, the link between Victorian geography and architecture, as well as entries for the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. This is going to take a while. And works on political protest, contagious diseases, the campaign for women's suffrage, and the 1926 general strike. He's currently at Cambridge, where he focuses on the history and philosophy of science, with a focus on 19th century laboratory culture. The reason why I rattled off some of his achievements, simply to observe that he apparently accomplishes more in 1 week than I have in the past 30 or 40 years. What is the meaning of sonorous? And for that matter, what is music? The Shorter Oxford defines music as the art of combining vocal or instrumental sounds, or both, to produce beauty of form, harmony, and expression of emotion. So beauty and emotion, where does science reside in that definition? And my romantic point of view, it's as lovely a thing as is emphasized in the epigraph of this book from The Tempest, one of my favorite passages, which then reminded me of Twelfth Night and Duke Orsino and If Music Be the Food of Love, Play On. The cover too is emblematic of the ardor and popularity of music and acoustic. It depicts the 1859 Handel Music Festival at the Crystal Palace. For a long time, a recording of this performance, again at the Crystal Palace on June 29th, 1888, was the oldest known recording of music until a performance of Clair de Lune was discovered in 1860. And you can listen to a haunting restoration of that on YouTube. It's amazing. And both the recordings are a perfect marriage of science and music in the 19th century. So without my further rattling, which many of you are accustomed, welcome, Edward, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. I should just say for professional reasons that I've just changed jobs and I've just taken up a new post at the Bartlett School of Sustainable Construction down in London. So I wouldn't want to portray myself as being anything that I wasn't. But thank you. That's a very kind introduction.
Well, I guess the beginning set the stage, if you will, of the fragile marriage of the sonorous and the scientific in the 1800s in England.
Yes. Well, by 1800s, I mean, are we talking sort of like into the 1820s and 30s, a little bit later in the century?
I have a better way of starting. So as a bookseller, I am obsessed with covers and with epigraphs for that matter. And you provide us not only with one, but one for each chapter. So if you start at the beginning, I guess a better way to start would be, what always fascinates me about the passage from The Tempest is that Caliban is, you know, waxing rhapsodically, but he doesn't really know where the music is coming from, whether it's Prospero or Ariel, or the key is the island itself. And I guess that's part of what you're trying to get at here is, where is it coming from? Does it come from nature? Does it come from man? Does it come from science?
I suppose, and that's the thing. I mean, it's so hard to describe music and sort of why it has the effect that it has on you. And I mean, I think that, you know, that why I picked that quote from Shakespeare, I mean, it is one of my absolute favorites, of course. And I was looking for an excuse to get it into a book because it's just so beautiful. But it's, I mean, Shakespeare, you know, is unquestionably, obviously, you know, so banal, but he's one of the, you know, absolute greatest writers of all time, without question. And yet when he comes to describe music, it's in this incredibly romanticized, beautiful way, but yeah, he doesn't know where it's coming from. And so if Shakespeare finds it hard to put a sort of more empirical spin, not that he would want to, on music, imagine how hard everyone else finds it. And traditionally, up until the 19th century, music is seen as this very romantic product. It's inseparable from broader questions over spirituality and divine creation. This is something that endures during the 19th century. I think, I hope the book shows this, you know, that sort of like religious authorities, priests, they give sermons and they're talking about sound and music. And it's, you know, you can't explain it sort of through science. You need to resort to metaphysical, spiritual accounts. Or if you're sort of in, I don't know, a romantic school of thought, you know, especially in sort of like early 1800s Germany, and obviously this endures the sort of romantic tradition, sound music is thought of in this very sort of unmaterialistic way. But then, of course, the book is showing how, you know, actually this understanding comes under increasing change, redefinition during the 19th century. I should say that's not to say this is the first time that natural philosophers and people, you know, are trying to apply more empirical understanding to explain how music is happening, what music is. Obviously, I mean, this is a tradition that goes back to the classics. It goes back to, you know, Ptolemy and Pythagoras. But in the 19th century, I think in the context of industrialization, urbanization, sort of these big processes, all these questions, you know, they start to take on increasing urgency and moral concern, perhaps.
Well, the first few pages, as you mentioned, you introduce Pythagoras into the equation. That's a poor pun. So, yeah, but why? I mean, I am, but why should we be concerned with 4-3 or the perfect fourth, or even the Chladni patterns on sheet metal? What are we, as a lay person who doesn't know about harmonics or doesn't know what the perfect fourth is, why early on do you introduce that? And is that your way of saying, hey, this is not the evocative feeling that you get when you listen to the William Tell Overture? It's much more than that.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, I think that you've picked up there on that there's a crucial disruption in the line of thought here. So you can have mathematical principles for sounds. You know, if you have a string vibrating at a certain frequency and you keep halving it, you can move through the octaves of C's or A's or whatever the string is tuned to. With Chladni's plates, you can put sand on a glass plate and you can put it into vibration and you can visualize, you can see how the plate is moving. You can see the waves moving through the plate as embodied by the dancing sand on top. So you can reduce what you're hearing to mathematical principles and to visual principles, and you can make sounds knowable. But what you can't do, and this is the leap, you can't explain why a certain combination of sounds in a certain melody, obviously you've got the individual notes, but then obviously the tune, the composition, why that has the emotional response on someone. As you say, you know, listening to a piece of music, you can sort of apply a mathematical analysis to the sounds, but that's so hard to do to the actual music. And that's almost the limits of scientific knowledge. And in the 19th century, this is something, you know, that is really under, you know, people are contesting this between religious authorities, scientific authorities, which is why the book is called Sound Authorities, because, you know, it's all these different individuals, all these different groups providing different explanations to make that leap from the mathematical conception of a sound to the emotional response to a piece of music.
Here's a quick question. Very early on, you use the word sonorous, and I'm wondering, okay, instead of sound, he says sonorous. And I wondered whether you meant it in terms of sound, or did you mean it as the rich peal of a church bell or the imposingly deep and rich sound of a world-class baritone? Because it could be either.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, part of the problem with the word sonorous, and in terms of trying to ascribe to that sort of like an understanding that it's aesthetically pleasing, is not everyone likes the same sounds. I mean, most people, you know, can identify a harmonious sound, but you've only got to think about how diverse music tastes are to think that actually something that's sonorously pleasing might not be sonorously pleasing to everyone. I think that I would rather think about sonorous, I suppose, as a broad umbrella term for sounds musical and sounds unmusical. I mean, obviously you've got sound, which is sort of the medium for music. And music by its very nature is sort of something that's supposed to be quite aesthetically pleasing. Whereas I suppose sonorous is, but I think also, I mean, sonorous, I would think of it as well in terms of natural phenomena that you might experience. So the experience of echo. I mean, one thing the Victorians are really interested in is the sonorous. I suppose modern word would be sonic, but they don't use that in the 19th century, as far as I know, but sort of the sonorous experience of the inside of churches, hearing choral music in there, but also hearing weird acoustic phenomena, like sonorous phenomena, like, I don't know, sort of like whispering galleries, like St. Paul's Cathedral, where if you stand at one point, you can hear perfectly a whisper, but you can't hear it at any stage sort of in between, you know, or odd things like that. So I think, and for 19th century authorities as well, sound and sonorous are used quite interchangeably. And when you read enough material from the 19th century, eventually you start writing like, you know, you have to be careful.
It's funny you said a whispering chamber is like in Grand Central Station, where you can stand on one side and hear someone talking through the arch. And yesterday I was with my friend and we were at my old house and I was checking the greenhouse and I had a really large traffic cone there. And one of the American orange traffic cones, the conical ones. Well, cones are conical. Anyway, it has a hole in the top. And I walk out of the greenhouse and he has this gigantic cone up to his ear like this. And I'm thinking, maybe he needs to be institutionalized. And he goes, he says, have you ever done this? And I did it. And it was amazing what you could hear. It was similar to a conch shell to your ear, but much, much more. And I had never heard of anyone doing that. But, right, this is what I do in these interviews. I just go off on my own tangent. We're trying to sell your book in a way. But the evocation of these things, like we were talking about, it's like, okay, your guys, your scientists, your musicians, like really are in love with music and they think it's the thing. But if you're looking at a Van Hoff or the smell of burning leaves or the taste of a good Bordeaux or your fingers brushing velvet, why is music unique? Why is it not just like those things?
That's interesting. I suppose, I mean, first of all, I would say what makes sound music such a historically valuable subject to study is, I suppose, I realize that obviously some people don't hear, you know, there are some people who are deaf, but the experience of music is one that is pretty universal to people with functioning ears. Whereas I'm not sure if everyone ever samples a good Bordeaux. Tragedy, you know, that is the tragedy. But I think that the first thing is the sort of the universality of experience. I mean, almost all cultures have some kind of music. I think the second thing that makes it quite historically interesting to explore as well is it's quite uncontrollable. It's very, very difficult to control who and how sound and music is experienced. I mean, if you walk past a church, you can hear people singing in it. So immediately someone passing by has some kind of opinion on that. Whereas the consumption of wine or the touch of certain fabrics, I think, is something that is perhaps more exclusive.
Yeah.
The other thing is, I mean, so that's from a very practical level. I think the other thing is that I know that I've already said that musical tastes differ, but discordant sounds that are genuinely unpleasant, like, you know, chalk on a blackboard. Everyone, almost everyone, can agree that that sounds horrific, that sounds terrible. And the combination, I don't know, if you ever play around with the violin, there's a combination of the two middle notes. What is it? Is it the A and the D strings? And you can get some really nice chords by playing those in a certain combination. And it is just a pleasant sound. It actually sounds like the first couple of notes of the 1812 overture. And I suppose the thing is that, like with a Bordeaux, you might get someone who absolutely can't stand a Cab Sauve dominant Bordeaux because they like the juicier fruits of the Merlot from the other side of the Gironde. So I think wine has the potential to be maybe more subjective, whereas the absolute sounds, there are some things that are just universally unacceptable. And that, I think that kind of gives it, that makes it problematic, because sound can be something that can be treated very scientifically. and yet at the same time also seems to have this property that transcends the scientific, I think.
Yeah, but what gives that the lie in my mind is that in one epigraph, where, who is it, Carlyle, who says that when music is healthy, it's like the best thing in the world, and when it's depraved, it's the worst thing in the world. But then you take, and then I thought, okay, Stravinsky, Rite of Spring, everyone gets up and walks out. But now it's a classic and it's beautiful, but, well, I don't think it's beautiful, but still, it's totally subjective and you're acting as if it's universal.
I think I would distinguish between like the music and the actual sort of raw sounds. So what I mean by that is, like, obviously everyone has different tastes. Music is completely subjective. But one of the subjects in the book was tuning forks and the question of what frequency do you play a C. Now, I did an experiment, and I don't have them with me now. I wish I did. But I have, if you get two tuning forks, now the mathematically pure C based on sort of, you know, 2, 4, 8, 16, etc., is a C of 512 vibrations per second. That's mathematically pure C. But no one likes that. It doesn't sound very good. If you take a tuning fork and you tap it, it doesn't sound very pleasant compared with a C of 528 vibrations or C of 540 vibrations, because a C that's tuned to a slightly higher frequency, it does sound brighter, it sounds more pleasant. And I have done this experiment with rooms of people at various conferences where I've taken along three tuning forks. You hit the 512 and it sounds dull and it just sounds unpleasant. Then you hit the 528 and it's a bit nicer. And then you hit one in the 540s and everyone's like, that's a nice sound. Now, obviously, music would mobilize that sound in different ways, which might be distasteful or pleasant. But the actual fundamental note, there is a sort of universality of experience of it.
Talk about the the pitch committee. Reminded me, like in Gulliver, of whether you crack your egg on the tops, on the pointed side or the rounded side. It was like you could go to war at the pitch committee, and the chart was kind of hilarious, but
it was mad. It is mad. But that's kind of, I mean, that it is sort of like this. You know, you have the mathematicians who want something that's just based on scientific principles. And even they admit that it doesn't sound very nice, I think. And yet, you know, you've got the musical community who are just completely concerned with aesthetics. And, you know, I don't think that there is a musician in England in the 1850s who would say that a C512 is a pleasant C. No one would say that. And actually, I was on the side of John Herschel when I was reading the original debates. I was like, if it's good enough for John Herschel, it's good enough for me. You know, he's the master of measurements and standards. And yet when I bought the tuning forks, you know, if you go online and I don't know if you can get sort of like a frequency thing where you can play a sound, play the 540 or whatever it is first, sounds all right. And then see if you can play 512 and you just... it's depressing. It's all, actually, my housemate described it as a gothic C because it sounded so dark.
You spend you devote a lot of time in this book to Herschel, and he's an astronomer. But
yeah.
So, and it's interesting that he's so important in your book because he's an astronomer. He's a musician as well.
Yeah, I mean, he said that he couldn't play the piano, but I think he was actually quite a good musician. His father was William Herschel, who discovered the planet Uranus,
right,
in 1781. He also was an organ. I mean, originally he was in the Hanoverian army, was a refugee to the UK, and he was a bandmaster, and he became a fantastic organist, and he continued playing the organ through his life. So there is a huge crossover between music and astronomy in the Herschel household. But I mean, John Herschel, he's a fascinating character. I will say that by the 1850s, the time that, I mean, the pitch committee is 1859 to 1860, I don't think he's very well. And I mean, I'm not saying that you'd have to be unwell to be interested in questions of pitch, but I think that in the mid-1850s, he had some sort of breakdown. If you look at pictures of him between, so if you look at pictures of him in like the 1830s, 1840s, right the way through to the early 1850s, he is quite a romantic figure. He's very good looking. You know, he's a real beau of science. He then takes a job working at the Royal Mint, which was a post that Isaac Newton held. You see, producing coinage, it requires such skills of precision and accuracy that actually astronomers make very, very good masters of the mint. And to sort out Britain's coinage, which was in a bit of a state, to set the gold standard, Herschel takes this job at the mint, and he works there for 5 years until 1855 and has to retire because he's overworked. And I think that he has some kind of breakdown, because there's a picture that's taken a few years later. And my goodness me, if that's what 5 years at the Royal Mint does to you, I mean, he just looks, you know, he's sort of completely, he doesn't look anything like the earlier pictures of him. And he's just, he looks absolutely washed out. He looks really haggard. And some of the stuff that he writes in the 1860s and 1870s later on is quite bizarre. He tries to introduce this sort of reorganization of the harmonic scales according to mathematical principles, which is just completely impractical. And even his scientific colleagues, you know, they all say, you know, why would you do that? You know, like trying to, I think it was trying to decimalize musical notes to sort of like perfect kind of like, instead of having like, you know, an eighth and a fifth, he was like trying to have like so many fractions of 100, which it was just completely mad. So I think Herschel had lost the plot a bit, but he was genuinely interested in broad questions of measurement, be it musical questions of length. He was always in favor of getting rid of the meter and the yard and replacing it with a measure based on, I think, either the rate of a beating pendulum being a perfect second at the North Pole or something like that. He just loved measurement, you know, standards. But then that's the astronomer. It's all about precision. So
it's funny because how old are you?
31.
Because when you're talking about what happened in 5 years, I'm thinking of myself, because I'll be 70 in 12 days. And I'm going, hey, wait a minute. I kind of used to look like him. And then when you're my age, you're going to think back to this interview and go, oh, what? He was right.
If you're near 70, you're in absolutely fantastic shape compared with John Herschel, who was younger. And he was, my goodness me. He was...
Well, that's, I think that may be damning with faint praise. I'm not sure, though, because I didn't see the picture.
Oh, no, I meant that.
If he looked really bad, I mean, that means I just look bad.
No. Kind of cut that from the interview.
Well, then you talk about a Faraday. And I mean, Faraday, Einstein kept a picture of Faraday on his wall. And his first love was music. But he discovered electromagnetism. That's what got me about the book. There's all these guys that love music, but in the meantime, they're discovering discovering electromagnetism or pouring out into areas that have nothing to do with music, especially Faraday.
I mean, it is interesting that, I mean, a lot of his work at the Royal Institution, because it is, you know, a public organ, the Royal Institution, a lot of his work is kind of, you know, just he does what he's told to do. And, you know, in between discovering electromagnetic rotation based on Oersted's principle in 1821 and discovering electromagnetic induction that was 1821, induction was 1831. In the 10 years in between, I mean, he wants to find out, I mean, obviously they know that a current and a magnet can produce movement, but they want to know how you induce electricity with a magnet and motion. And that's the big principle that he wants to work out. But really he can't do it for about 10 years because he's constantly given all this really tiresome work developing glass, which is, you know, sort of a national public concern. It's interesting that when he actually is allowed to do his own research, the first thing he does is start looking at sort of like acoustic patterns and looking at how sounds make visual forms. And I think it's probably because, and it comes back to this romance question, Faraday's immensely religious and he has this fantastic view of the universe. You know, it's everything in the universe is all connected. It's all produced by this divine creator. And he's a Sandemanian. So he's, you know, from, I think there's only like 1,000, 2,000 members of this church, and they all have to live their life according to the example of Christ. It's very strict. So for him, studying sound and music is as important to providing a complete vision of the universe that God has created as studying electricity and magnetism and things that might be of more immediate practical use. So I think it comes back to these sort of romantic views of what music and sound are and what they can tell you about God, creation, the universe, and our place in it. There's, you know, a lot of belief that there's secrets in music.
Yeah, and you say that in your conclusion as well. But it's funny because the chapter one epigraph, which is Browning parlaying with Avison, and I love the term parlaying because, you know, it's like this, you come up to the gate of the castle and the guy comes out and you start talking to him. But then I was thinking of Aragorn outside of Mordor when the guy comes out and he just slices his head off. So that's not really parlaying.
Yeah. But
yeah, it's not really not fair, but he deserved what he got and he wasn't human anyway. So, and there I go. See, that's what I do. But the funny thing about that epigraph is that he's parlaying with Avicen, and then Avicen gave Faraday a job as first violinist in the Newcastle Orchestra. And that's really? Your epigraph. Yeah, I found that out. And that's your chapter two, George Eliot, Middlemarch, where he said he broke the barrier of science. So yeah, I could be wrong. I'm wrong about half the stuff. I was wrong about Carlyle, it was Ruskin. So.
No, wow. It's always nice talking to someone else about something that you've written because usually they can tell you more about it than you know yourself.
Well, maybe, but you got to watch it with me because I make stuff up and I just think, well, that might be true. And then half the time it is, but I think this is true. So the other interesting thing, and I'm going through these epigraphs because it really tied the book together. And I also know, again, as a bookseller, that authors must think a lot about their epigraphs because they're very important to them. So you must have spent a lot of time doing that.
Yeah, well, I do collect potential epigraphs whenever I read something. I mean, the Shakespeare one picked itself. I've known it, obviously.
Yeah, me too.
Still, and any excuse to get that in. I like a Shakespeare quote. My favorite epigram of all time is in, there's a classic, you might well know it, but what was it? Not epigram, yeah, epigraph, sorry, I get mixed up between two. There's a book, do you know Leviathan and the Air Pump by Stephen Shapin and Simon Shaffer? And obviously it's all about sort of induction in experiments, but experiments being very dangerous for the state. And they have that fantastic quote from Richard III. And it's something like, I can't remember, it's something like, inductions I've laid, plots dangerous, or something like that. And it's just because, you know, it's like this idea that if you do an experiment that, you know, proves that there's a vacuum in nature, you might have established a principle that there can be a vacuum in government, and then you wouldn't need a king. And I just love it that it's come from Richard III. So that I kind of, when I read that as an undergraduate, that was really inspirational. And I sort of, I've always tried to have epigrams when I can find them for books.
The first thing I do when I read something that's difficult for me, in my mind, it goes, is this induction or is it deduction? And it takes me a while to figure out which one I'm dealing with. It's funny that you dealt with government because that one quote from Napoleon, basically saying music is power and you much use it to legislate, which goes back to Wagner and Hitler. But I don't know if that's what you were getting at in that one.
I mean, I think so. I mean, it was kind of like a double play. Like I thought that as well, but then also I thought it was interesting that I think that was for the chapter on pitch, wasn't it? Was that?
Yeah, and you quote, you know, you talk about Punch magazine and the musicality of Parliament.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that there were so many like overlaps, and also I think, you know, it's about using music to govern society, but then of course that chapter was also about trying to govern music by, you know, regulating it with a pitch. So I kind of thought, you know, if you're going to regulate society with music according to some sort of Bonapartist manifesto, then first you've got to organize the music correctly. You've got to discipline the music. So then, and this is a bit of a long shot and it's rhetorical and it's a bit, you know, journalistic, but tuning forks regulate society by regulating music. I don't know whether Napoleon would have thought that, but Napoleon III, you know, he was the guy that sort of got the Diapason Normal, you know, set up the French standard in 1859. So evidently musical discipline was something that meant a lot to the Bonapartes. So.
Since you brought up tuning forks a couple of times, you should talk about one, rather than me talking, explain this, because the best part of this is you use the word grim. So you, the boys experiment with the spiders and the paraffin. Talk about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm indebted to a friend of mine, Jack Matthews, who I was talking about this book to him. We did our defils together at Oxford, and I met up with him and he asked what I was doing. And I started telling him about the book, and he said, I was reading Nature, as you do. I was reading Nature from the 1880s the other day, and I was reading about some bizarre experiment in which a physicist called Boyce was trying to sort of coerce a spider to do things that it wouldn't want to do using a tuning fork. And I sort of thought, well, this sounds completely insane, but I'll go and give it a... I mean, you see, the thing with Nature as a journalist, it's a very important organ for late 19th century science, because it's set up under the editorialship of Norman Lockyer, who's this great reformer he sees himself as a great reformer, who wants to get the state to finance science in a way that it's never done before. So Nature's kind of a way, it's where you publish things to try and emphasize, this is how science could be of use to the state and to the governments, which I think at the moment with COVID and all that is actually quite a relevant point. So for this article about, you know, sort of soaking flies in paraffin, putting those in the web, seeing if the spider will eat them. Obviously it wouldn't, because, you know, spiders aren't idiots. But then if you get a vibrating tuning fork and start vibrating the web, or start vibrating the fly so the spider thinks it's alive, the spider would then eat the fly. And I think, you know, there's so much going on there. I mean, obviously this guy had too much time on his hands, and obviously he, you know, just like spending time in his garden with the spiders. But quite clearly, you know, there's a thing there, isn't there, like vibration, is that life in a sense? You know, there's lots of theories over what, you know, what it is to be alive in the 19th century, you know, especially, you know, concerns with sort of like the nervous system and electricity. But you've got actually someone here who's thinking, you know, just vibration is enough to convince a relatively primitive animal to sort of think something else is alive. And I don't know, it's...
I was thinking, I thought was, I wonder what else he was touching a tuning fork to. Not to go into, never mind.
I don't know. I don't think he followed up that research. I think eventually he went into research on bubbles, which is quite cool. Later on, he became a really respected scientist and won loads of prizes for his investigations into sort of like the structure and the composition of giant bubbles that he was blowing, you know. So in fact, there's a really good picture of him in the Royal Society, fantastic picture of him just with a giant bubble. It looks far better than that Millet picture of bubbles that they used to put on, you know, soap adverts in the 1860s.
Well, given how prolific you are at 31, maybe your next work should just simply be bubbles. Just bubbles.
John Millet did that bubbles painting and it ruined his reputation. Even Ruskin couldn't applaud that. So I think bubbles is something to be... Bubbles is, and I wouldn't want to follow in Boyce's footsteps because I think he was mad.
I wouldn't want to either. Something wrong with that guy.
But, yeah.
But it would make a great cover. And it would sell. Oh, that's, yeah. Do you have the book there? I can hold it up, but you can hold it up too.
I actually did. You know, I was reading it just before I came, just to try and remind myself what was in it. So, God, because I wrote this before the pandemic. So it was actually due to be published about 2020. But of course, the pandemic held it back by about 2 years. So a lot of this stuff I kind of wrote 2017, 2018, a long time ago. It's sort of 3 books back now. So I did have to actually read it to remind it. And it's nice because it's like reading it by someone else. So
yeah, I know.
I'm now more of a reviewer than a writer.
So show the cover.
Oh, yes.
So, yes. So it's on the back jacket, it explains what it is, and I briefly alluded to it in the introduction, but I looked at it like, wow, everyone is really excited to be here. But I don't know if that was, well, again, like I said, as a bookseller, and I say this in every single interview, you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but every single customer I have judges every book by its cover unless they came in looking for a specific book. So if they go to the front table where this will be, they're going to say, wow, this is interesting. And they'll open it up and then they see Shakespeare. So that's why I like both of them together.
I love this cover because I think in this cover, it sums up an awful lot. So, I mean, obviously you've got the Great Exhibition, which you don't really know what to do with. I mean, it's the Crystal Palace. but they don't really know what to do with this vast space after the, it's a bit like the Millennium Dome in London. You know, they sort of built it and didn't know what to put in it after, you know, the initial exhibitions. So you've got the most sort of famous building in the world at the time, and it's being devoted to music, musical culture. England, I mean, England is very, was very unique at the time for having these big choral performances. I mean, that's, you know, a distinctly English musical genre. But then I like it as well, because obviously the question, Tuning Forks, discipline, ordering society. I mean, look at how nice and ordered all the people are. It's kind of like Victorian society at its most disciplined. And yet they're all around the centrality, the domineering power of the organ, which in itself is a hugely significant instrument, because it's unique in being an instrument that is supposed to be able to create the phenomena and the sounds of almost every other instrument. And at the same time, it's an inherently religious device. And of course, so much of the book was about religion, that to actually have all of society gathered around a church organ, basically, is quite exciting. And then, of course, also the church, these organs are incredibly, by the mid-19th century, they're incredibly industrialized products. So you've then got the context of industrialization. So I probably should stop going on about this, but I really...
Well, no, because these are like gnomons of what's inside. And the other thing I think about when I look at it is, I wonder how they manage the acoustics in here.
Oh God, I have no idea.
Nor do I. I mean, and that's the other thing about a pipe organ, and I'm sure you do this, but if you walk by a church and someone is practicing the pipe organ, there's no way I can't go in.
Yeah. They are, well, they're quite mystical. They're kind of very spiritual instruments as well, I think. And they really, sometimes, you know, church organ, I don't know if it's playing, you know, sort of Elgar or something, or, you know, something quite gripping, it's really quite overwhelming, I think. And
or Bach. I mean,
Yeah.
What's the deal with a fugue? I mean, you have that Douglas Hofstetter's book, Gödel, Escher, Bach, An Eternal Golden Braid. You know, it's music. There you go. It's music, it's mathematics, and it's art combined in one thing, this recursive nature of the fugue state, which is also catatonia. I don't know. Here I am again. But the other thing you say at the very end is, you say exactly what you just said, demystifying music is demystififying nature.
Yeah. And in the same way that demystifying nature is demystifying the church and religion, you know, sort of like, that's why, you know, that's why in Catholicism, you don't want to lose the mystery, do you? Because no, it's all about the mystery. And the mystery itself is very beautiful.
That's the church and the organ. And like you said, the organ's an industrial manufacturer. And inside the church, you sit there, but nonetheless, you immediately feel that there is something, as you say, beyond the material world. Why do you feel that way?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's why I wrote a book on it.
when you reread the book, did you think that the author had explained it?
I think that the author had explained what people in the 19th century thought about it.
I don't know. You can't rely on your subtitle to get out of that question.
I think there's a point where there are some things that society, large portions of society actually don't want. I'm not a politician, I'm a historian, and I'm not a theologian. But I think that there might well be things in the world that perhaps large portions of society don't really want to have demystified. And I think that in this book, I would say, as a sort of secondary definition of this book, it's a book on the limits of 19th century scientific knowledge, because, you know, scientific knowledge, you know, is set up. I know that it's not always in conflict with religion, but it's so often set up in conflict with religion, especially in the 1860s and 70s with people like Thomas Huxley and John Tyndall. They're not necessarily hostile to religion. Some are, but they're not necessarily hostile. But they want to remove religious authority from questions of nature. They want to say, to be an authority on nature, you can't be in the church. You have to be a professional scientist. It's actually more of a professionalizing thing than a secularizing movement. And, you know, I would say that they were probably, that program by the 20th century is largely successful. I mean, I think it's quite clear that overall societies tended in Britain, it has tended to move from being dominantly religious to not dominantly religious, or if it is religious, but then with science as a very separate thing. I mean, we don't have priests going into the laboratories anymore. So that separation has occurred. But with music, I don't know whether that ever does really happen. I think that the fact we're talking about it now, I think shows that music is still quite romantic and it is still something metaphysical and spiritual. And I'm not a scientist, I'm not a musicologist either, so I can't tell you why a certain piece of music sounds so fantastic. Maybe I don't want to tell you why. Maybe I quite like just to think that it's just emotionally engaging.
Where I'm being unfair, because you chose your topic and you've used the word society a couple of times. You're talking about society and I'm trying to get you to answer about the individual. And that's not fair. Unless you want to do it, and I understand what you're saying, you can't. But nor can I, but I'm asking, I wonder why he didn't tell me why the individual feels like Weldon Champneys says, you need air for life and you need air for music. So I thought about that for a while. So we need air to live and we need music to live. Or no?
Yeah. No, I think there are so many bits of daily life where music is important that...
But is it crucial?
Yeah, I think it might be. I mean, yeah, I think it actually, I think probably for mental health, it might well be quite crucial. I mean, I like running and I'd be absolutely lost if I was out running and I didn't have certain bits of music at certain times. I know it's a very frivolous thing to say, but when you're really tired and you need a bit of a pickup, I've got a very calculated playlist, which sort of during the miserable long miles in between has very therapeutic, slow pieces of music just to keep myself calm. But then I've got it timed so that at the end of the runs are always the same length. You know, you've got something to really pick you up at the end and it does change your entire state. And, you know, sometimes if you can't get to sleep, put on some Vaughan Williams. Well, so
when I ran my one and only marathon in Las Vegas, that was way back when you were a teenager, and my iPod, the battery was not good. So halfway through the battery died and it just ruined everything. In addition to the fact that it was the coldest day in the history of Las Vegas, the wind was 35 miles an hour against me. There was glass in the road and they ran out of water. So I don't know which one it was. And when I ended the run, I always play this song by Lenny Kravitz called Black Velveteen, because the pace of it is exactly the pace that you want to finish the race. So I did the same thing as you. I had a playlist that was designed to go, it's interesting, to go up to the peak and then back down again and then back up. But
it's possible once you're really tired with the right bit of music to work yourself up into a complete sense, like the endorphins kick in, you get some music. And, you know, you just get a moment of complete euphoria, which drags you through a really miserable bit of running. So
when I was in prep school and I was running cross country, and this was in 1970, the last bit was a football field. So you had to run between the goalposts. And that last 100 yards, all I did was play it in my head. Mm. And that was what did it then. People don't do that anymore.
I suppose it's also nostalgia as well, maybe. I mean, music takes you back to places. It reminds you of people that perhaps are gone. You know,
that's what I said about, but that's true about burning leaves too. When I smell burning leaves, I think back to my old house and Halloween and trick or treat. Yeah.
Well, I think actually there's probably a lot of trends in sort of current historical study that is sort of taking a more multi-sensual encounter sort of approach to study. So much of history has been optically, visually defined. I mean, actually, this book does build on developments within sound studies. You know, the history of science in particular, knowledge production, has predominantly been one of sight. You know, telescopes, microscopes, you know, visual order of the laboratory. But actually, there are so many skills involved in producing knowledge and just daily experiences. And if we want to provide good histories, I mean, I really like, there was a book written by William White he was my ex-supervisor, and he wrote this brilliant book called Unlocking the Victorian Church, or something like that. But it was a multi-sensorial account of the Victorian Church. It was how did they sound? How did they smell? What was it like to be sitting in there? And not just the sight. The sight was important. What about what you were hearing, you know, in terms of the sermon? And it was trying to, you know, sort of immerse the reader, to give them a sense of, you know, the sense that these were spaces, these were buildings that were doing a lot of things in different ways. Obviously, this book is focused on sound. But in other work that I'm doing at the moment, I'm sort of looking at more at tactile, sort of like hands and sort of like feeling in scientific experiment. I've been doing a lot of sort of, these are the things that people don't record in their accounts of historical experiments. But actually, you know, sort of like the tactile skills, they're very important to performing experiments. I'm really interested in magnetic, like the 19th century efforts to measure the Earth's magnetic field. And you have to do this using very, very delicate needles, like basically a compass on its side. And you point it at the North Pole and it measures how strong the direction of the Earth's magnetic field is. But you have to get rid of the friction on the needle. So you have to rub it very, very gently with like a sort of a pad in your hand. And you can only really do this experiment if you have developed sort of like a very, very delicate sense of touch. And I quite like that as well. You know, touching something is important to making knowledge about something. Hearing, maybe tasting, depends what you're doing. Faraday would taste stuff, I suppose. You know, so I think, yeah, moving away from the eye, be it for the ear or the hand, is quite valuable.
Well, when you're talking about nostalgia and then with your mentor and writing about what it must have been like back then, because you can't recover the senses, you can only recover basically somebody's version of what happened. But that's why in the introduction, when I said I listened to that Clair de Lune from 1860, and obviously it was a horrible recording and you could barely hear the girl singing, but it scared the hell out of me. And also it was beautiful and haunting because you knew that she was there. But unlike what about Hoffman? So he recoils in horror at the preservation of music on whatever, wax, vinyl, CDs, streams. Would he still feel the same now? He does say that all mechanical music is abhorrent. Would Hoffman still feel the same way when the quality is as good as it is now? Just the fact that it's reproduced?
I think he would probably, if he was being philosophically consistent with himself when he was alive back then, I think that he would probably, I don't think it's the sound necessarily. I think right. it's the industrialization, the mechanization of something that is so fundamentally beautiful. There is a bigger debate. There was a really good article, I forget who wrote it, but there was a bigger debate over, you know, when sort of automatic playing pianos were used in concerts, do you applaud? Do you applaud the machine? I'm working on a project with a very brilliant Italian scholar at the moment, and it's on the use of barrel organs in Catholic churches in Italy, rather darkly during sort of like, you know, the period of Mussolini's fascism. And like the question, they were running out of organists. There weren't enough people in Italy who knew how to play the organ to keep all of these churches supplied with music. So, you know, there was this huge theological controversy. Can you have an automatic playing barrel organ in a church that's just wound up and plays itself? You know, is that still sacred music? So, you know, I think these are questions that are, yeah, probably endure. I think Hoffman would maintain his position on that.
Yeah, it's like the Beatles using the Mellotron. I always thought about that. And the other thing would be, oh yeah, Player Piano by Kurt Vonnegut. It's like AI now taking jobs away. They took the best organist in the world and they just had him play as good as he could. And then they got rid of him because all they had to do was replicate the motion of his hands on the keys and they could obtain as good a sound as possible. And actually, maybe part of the book is the idea of whether imbuing science into the very core of music, even that is that abhorrent to anybody? The idea that, okay, this is a human being from his heart and his mind playing this. And now is it right for you to co-opt that from him into a machine? And he's no longer relevant. Or, you know, you're relevant to this book, but after you die and the book lives on, is it the same thing as me talking to you here?
I don't know. I mean, that the latter question there, I have no idea. I mean, to be honest, I'll just be glad if anyone's still reading it by the time I'm dead. I mean, I'm hoping that I'm going to live a little bit longer, but we'll see. But in terms of, yeah, I mean, sort of, you know, I think any time that there's a sort of encroachment into music with a sort of more, taking a more scientific approach, I suppose it's probably how it's framed, actually, I think, as to how threatening it's perceived to be and how much of a problem it's perceived to be. Mary Somerville writes brilliantly about music and sound and sonorous phenomena. And yet it's acceptable to almost everyone. Musicians quote her, scientists quote her. It's acceptable because she writes it within this very Anglican framework. It's framed within this bigger vision of the cosmos. And she uses beautiful analogies. I mean, it's sort of like comparing, you know, the movements of planets through the universe with, you know, a finely tuned organ. And, you know, sort of like invoking all of that romantic stuff about, you know, sort of like the harmony of the spheres, all the planets being different notes. So she, you know, has this sort of, I forget the exact phrase, but it's, you know, sort of like this very spectacular vision of nature, which is religious, which is aesthetically pleasing. And then she can deliver quite a mathematical account of sound and by implication, what's making music, you know, in terms of oscillating particles. And people, I mean, sermonizers reference her in their sermons to their, you know, to their congregation. So that's acceptable. But then if you get someone like John Tyndall writing about music and like trying to say, well, you know, it's a completely material process. It's like growing a tree. It's just material. It's just the transfer of light and energy into a tree. Sound is exactly the same. And he's also saying, you know, quite damning on the church. All of a sudden, people start writing complaints to him and sort of like challenging that position. So I think a lot of it is the theological framing, I would argue. So I think it can be acceptable if it's managed well.
Whether it's the planets or the music or the harmony of the spheres, which is so interesting because last week, I don't know if you saw it, they released this sound of black hole, the sound of a black hole. Did you watch
it? Really? No, I didn't.
And I mean, I have no idea whether it's an analogy or a metaphor, but it's there. You can play it. It's the sound of a black hole. Have you listened to the one of the sound of wind on Mars?
Yes, I have. That was quite haunting.
I was just same word I was just going to use. Why is it? Okay, there you go. I'm trying
there
to.
We are. You see, universality. We know it's haunting.
Yes, exactly. Both of us were going to use the same word at the same time. Why?
I suppose experiences through life.
And no, because if it's society and if we get 10 people in the room and they all say it's haunting, then it's haunting. But I don't even know what that
experience is.
I don't even know what haunting means.
Yeah.
Why is it haunting?
It does, yeah. It is quite chilling. I suppose the way to test this theory would be to take someone from, I mean, you and I are from quite a similar, I mean, we are from, I would say probably quite a similar cultural background in many respects. You know, we have access to the same programs on TV. We've probably read similar books, you know, and I suppose growing up in sort of like Western Europe and in America, a lot of things that you might identify as being a bit chilling or a bit creepy are probably very similar. But perhaps if you, oh God, this is going to sound like so 19th century racialized, but maybe if you, to test this theory, you would have to take someone who'd not been exposed to any Western culture at all and see whether they also identified the sound as chilling to find out whether this was universal to humans or whether it was the result of cultural shaping.
Yeah, the other thing, and I don't mean this to compliment either you or me, you more than me, is that both of us, not only culturally, but both of us, it seems that our life's work is to absorb and to obtain as much information as we can about everything. And I think that's part of it too. I don't know why.
Definitely, yeah. No, I think, and the more you learn and the more that you read, I think that sort of provokes imagination, doesn't it? And when you hear something and you think that's haunting, I mean, it conjures up a lot of, I mean, yeah, I don't really know why. Of course, the most haunting sound of all is absolute silence, isn't it? That's the quote from H.G. Wells' The Time Machine, that one day when all the heat in the universe is gone and the universe is subject to the cold, inevitable death, there will be no sound, no sound at all.
I thought of entropy throughout this book. And sometimes I knew why I was thinking of it. Sometimes you actually said it, but the other times I didn't. Well, the idea of this complete organization gradually becoming incredibly disordered. Mm-hmm. And then I couldn't figure out why that applied to music, other than the quote you just, from your H.G. Wells quote at the head of the chapter in one of my favorite books. Yeah, what is it? What is, is there a tendency towards disorder that from time to time pops up in the book that scientists believed that gave rise to their investigations to music, to forestall that tendency to disorder, or to describe why it was happening even with the context of music itself?
What, I mean, the scientists sort of being disposed to think of nature in a state of disorder.
Well, the one quote about organization. Yeah, there was a quote about organization and complete disarray. And the idea that things tend towards that, I don't know where I'm going. It's simply that there are moments in the book where entropy entered into my mind. I don't quite know why, so could be completely off base here.
I mean, I suppose, again, it's quite a religious question. If you show that there's order in the universe, that suggests a creator. I mean, it goes back to Paley's watch. And I mean, I think that the big treaties like Mary Somerville and John Herschel and, you know, sort of these fantastic science writers in the 1830s and 40s, the big project is to unite everything and to put it all into one working system. I suppose it's, although that could also be quite atheistic. Laplace, the great French mathematician, Mechanics, what was he wrote? You know, the system de Le Monde, you know, that's all about the world being in perfect order, but it explained through mathematical principles. And of course, there's that famous quote, apocryphal, you know, Napoleon says to, he did think he was God, but Napoleon said to Laplace, you know, where's God in your treatise, in this account of the universe? And, you know, apparently Laplace, you know, said that he had no need of that hypothesis. And of course, you get these science writers in the 1830s and 40s, like Somerville, and they're basically trying to show that everything's united, because if they do that, they think that they've provided evidence of a creator. And
well, it's like standing on the shoulders of giants. Look, the standard model, these four forces, and Faraday and Herschel are both involved in creating the basis for Einstein's what became the standard model, which is, the only thing missing is gravity, but the electromagnetism is a nice thing to throw in there. So yeah, the standard model explains all the forces in the universe and how they all work together. And that's what all scientists, in essence, as you say, are striving for, the description of perfect order.
I think the thing is, what's interesting about I think that's absolutely right. And I think what's interesting about the 1830s is there's so much hope that they're like just on the cusp of getting that right. Because the important thing about Faraday's work is, you know, like, people have known about magnetic phenomena for years, centuries. I think, you know, like the 11th century China, they knew about magnetic phenomena. Electricity has been known about since, you know, time immemorial. Light, heat, sound, all of these things are all known about. And yet when Oersted, you know, discovers that a magnetic needle will wobble around if you pass an electric current past a wire that's nearby, like, oh my goodness, you know, magnetism and electricity are related in some way. And that's why Faraday's obsessed with trying to reverse engineer that experiment, because, you know, if you've shown that electricity is related to magnetism, the next big challenge that Faraday faces after electromagnetic induction is to show that light is related to magnetism and electricity, because that would be adding another force to this overall vision of the universe. And I think it's 1844 where, you know, sort of like by the use of incredibly powerful prisms and, you know, pieces of glass, he does manage to get a ray of light, polarized light, to bend in reference to a magnet, he doesn't really know how that works. And it takes the link, obviously, between Faraday and Einstein is, you know, James Clerk Maxwell, who mathematically explains what's going on here. And there's this wonderful moment where Maxwell and Faraday do meet up you know, Faraday's almost dead and Maxwell's very, very young, and they do have a moment where they meet, which must have been one of the most interesting scientific conversations ever not recorded.
So. Until we had this conversation, I really didn't know why Einstein had Faraday's picture on his wall. Now I do.
Yeah, I would have been nice if he'd had Maxwell's as well. Maxwell is always the forgotten. I would say in history of science, you're not really supposed to have heroes. We've moved beyond the age of hero worshipping in the history of science. History of science is very self-avowed about this. But I would suspect, and I can't prove this, but I would suspect if you've got the majority of historians of science at Cambridge at the moment, which has kind of got the big history of science department, if you were to take them out, get them, you know, give them a few drinks, and you said, come on, who's the greatest? Who's the greatest scientist of all time? Just say, I'd bet more than half would say J.C. Maxwell.
I don't know. It would, Newton and, I don't know. I don't know anymore, as you said. And then also what you said is back then they thought they were on the cusp. Well, we think we're on the cusp too. I think we're always on the cusp.
Yeah, except, well, you know.
Something happened a couple of weeks ago that screwed up the standard model. And I can't remember what it is, but you can look it up. Something happened, but I can't. It wasn't at CERN because they're redoing CERN right now. But somewhere something happened and they went, oh. But whenever they think they're going to screw up the standard model, whatever happens, it always goes back to Einstein was right.
Well, I think we always need to be on the cusp, because it's important to always be on the cusp to get the next lot of research funding, doesn't it?
Well, that and should a man's reach exceed his grasp? I mean, otherwise we would just stop messing around with it in the first place. But yeah. Even the cosmological constant he thought it was the biggest mistake of his life, and it turned out, if he had just known that there was dark matter and dark energy, he would have realized, hey, how the hell could he have been right about his biggest failure? You know?
That's, yeah. Well, we must all aspire to be able to look back on our careers and be like that.
All right. I've been bugging you for over an hour now. Okay. So since you said you wrote this, started this, messed around with it till 2020, and you said that's 3 books ago. Now you have to tell me what the books are, that how the hell you come out with this many books. I have no idea, but why don't you tell me what's coming up?
Let me think. I can tell you why, and it's a very bizarre story. People think that I'm very, very prolific, and the simple truth is that I'm not. I just had a very, very fortunate series of events, actually. It was just very, very lucky. An old professor of mine had recently retired, and he was a historian of maritime history, and he wanted to travel around the world, but by ship, obviously. But he wanted to go sort of around South America by ship over the course of 3 months. And he didn't really know, he didn't really have anyone to go with and who would, you know, do that. And I was in the writing up stage of this book. So I said, I'd love to come with you. And it was kind of like when you buy a cabin, you get like 2 berths. It's the same price, 1 for 2. So it was like a free writing trip on a ship. And he's lovely company too. And he's a historian of science. So I knew I'd have a good sounding board. And I accepted it. And 3 months at sea is a long, long time. And there is nothing else to do. There's no internet. And I basically wrote most of the book then. And then in the evenings, I was, you know, I wanted to do something that wasn't this book. So I wrote this book up here, which came out last month. This is the second book. This is that's the Entente Imperiale. So I've written that since Sound Authorities. So that's the second one. And I wrote that in the evenings on that voyage. I did take some notes in preparation because I thought it might be like that. And that was actually just a bit of fun. And then the other two books, well, then I went on another voyage the next year because he enjoyed it so much. He wanted to do it again, this time around Africa and to Asia and Sri Lanka. So, of course, I had to take more work to do. So then that was a book on magnetic science in the 19th century, the world's first truly global magnetic, well, actually the world's, it's probably the first global science. In the 18th century, the 19th century, the British government financed this vast measurement of the Earth's magnetic field because they were frightened that the Earth's magnetic field was going to interrupt with compasses. And on iron ships, that would make them unnavigable. So they charted all the world's oceans, like for the magnetic character, sent out ships. You know, the John Franklin expedition where they got stuck in the ice. The John then they all eat each other because they get sucked out. That was one of these surveys to go out and chart magnetism in the North Pole. James Clark Ross's expedition to the South Pole, the Antarctic, was a magnetic expedition. All of these expeditions in the 1840s and 50s that are really celebrated in the history of science and expedition, most of them were primarily to obtain magnetic data because the British state was obsessed with it. And it's the first global experiment. It's the first massive state-funded scientific venture. So there's lots of relevance for that to, you know, sort of current questions of COVID and climate change. So I wanted to kind of look at the original model for that sort of like interaction between government and science. That's the second one. And then the third one is, what's that about? Acoustics. We've been talking about this.
And you said sound more too. It's so funny. I noticed that whenever someone's talking about their topic, whether they're doctors or whatever, like for you're talking and you're saying he was a good sounding board. And I realized you can't help using metaphors. It happens. I don't know why, but it happens all the time. The third book about acoustics.
So I wrote, my first book was on the Houses of Parliament and the uses of science in building the new Palace of Westminster after the original one burnt down in 1834. And the palace became this sort of place of experiment. They turned the House of Commons into a chemistry laboratory and performed all these experiments on MPs and experiments with the clock, the one that's famous as Big Ben, although it isn't Big Ben. You know, that's sort of, they wanted to make that the most accurate clock in the world. And clocks back then, you know, they were like the ultimate technology in terms of mechanical engineering. So that was pretty cool. One thing I didn't really look at, I only looked at for about two or three pages, bizarrely, was the question of acoustics in the debating chambers, House of Commons and House of Lords. And of course, when I was looking into this sound book, I kept coming across experiments that had taken place in the Houses of Parliament on how MPs could hear each other in these rooms because they were very acoustically challenging. And that got me thinking on this subject. And I thought, I really need to go back to Parliament and I need to look at what's going on with the acoustics. And I started reading, I found all these papers on acoustic technologies and acoustic experiments at Parliament from basically when they built them in the 1840s through to like 2000, like really recently. And they've always been difficult places to get the sound right. And they keep redesigning the inside of the buildings. They start developing new technologies and proposed technologies like, you know, there was a mad scheme, you know, to sort of like have speaking tubes into the House of Commons that, you know, would convey sound around London so that people could listen to debates over breakfast. And Parliament became the place where in the 1870s, 1880s, it was one of the first places to sort of have, you know, constant telegraphic communication of reports. So this book actually moved beyond acoustics and became more of a question of communicating knowledge from the political space to the rest of the country. And I looked at lots of different media, not just acoustics within the building, but kind of the communication of sound through like recording devices, radios, sound systems within the building, and eventually, obviously, the radio broadcasting and the televising of Parliament, because it really like at the forefront of all of these developments and really quite an experimental space, because for a Parliament to be active in society, it has to have its deliberations known. So, you know, it's...
Yeah, but in my opinion, the accuracy of the reproduction of Boris Johnson's voice is of no moment to me, nor in the United States as well. It's a shame. The content is of no use anymore.
That's a very interesting question. And that's one that I wanted to
look at. That's a good point for a book. In America, where there is no civil discourse, what's the point of the reproduction of the sound accurately if there's no content?
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I haven't written this book yet. I'm sort of still at the research stage, but that is definitely, thank you. That is a very, very good point.
No, if you put that in there, then you should dedicate a portion of it to me.
I will, yes, I will, definitely. Hang on a minute, where's my pen? I shall make a note and I shall add you to the ever-growing list of...
Of acknowledgements.
Yeah.
Put me towards the beginning. Put me towards the end. And I couldn't, yeah. And lastly, without...
Dedicated to you. No,
you can dedicate it to your nan again. You can never dedicate too many books to your nan.
Oh, no, I think the next one's going to have to be... I've got a few supervisors I need to dedicate books. Oh, I shouldn't have said that on here. That ruins surprise.
Now you're going to miss it.
I have a lot of a lot of intellectual debts that I need to spend the rest of my life writing books to acknowledge. So that.
Okay, here's the hardest part of every interview for me. I hate doing it. Okay, here we go. So, thanks, Edward. Our guest today is Edward J. Gillen, author of Sound Authorities, Scientific and Musical Knowledge in 19th Century Britain. It was released in February. It's on our front table. And now I have 6 or 7 more of his books to add to my front table. And I don't know where to put them because there's no room left in my bookstore. But Edward, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been really fun.
Oh, thanks. No, it's been lovely. Thanks. It's been lovely meeting you. And wow,
Likewise.
I don't think anyone's ever read it so thoroughly. So thank you very much indeed. Actually, that's not fair. The people on the back read it very, very well as well. So
we did it again. You're going to be in big trouble.
Yeah, I'm. God, this is going to be. You need to edit this.
Well, they're going to say. So you talk to this American guy who's saying American guy, and you think he's read it better than we have?
I think everyone read it really, really well. Actually, yes, very, very well. I'm overwhelmed, but thank you very much.
That's it. We're done now. Okay, Edward. I'll see you soon.
Thanks. Take care.
Yeah. Bye-bye.